This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
We're back. Mike O'Neill here with Mike Russell. Okay, guests. Major terrorism event in France, and a new governor and a new administration in Arizona. Our guest, Jalene Lissay, conflict expert. We're going to start her off talking about France, and then Steve Goldstein, host of KJazz's Here and Now. He gets to answer questions about Arizona, and they can kibitz on the other's turf and are invited to do so.
Now, you brought in a conflict expert for you and I?
Yeah.
See, I didn't think we've reached that level just yet, but if we have, all right, let's keep her around.
Give it time, buddy. Give it time. Okay, Jalene, let's talk more serious than in this room. Major terrorism in France and the reaction to it. Is this just more of the same? And how do you feel about how the way the world's reacting?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This morning I was, reading my online news, and there was an article by Christiane Amanpour. And it was her getting her reactions from Muslims about the new cover of the...
Charlie Hebdo?
Yes, the magazine that just came out. And asking their reaction, how do they feel about them putting the Prophet Muhammad on once again?
With a tear in his eye.
With a tear in his eye. But what I thought was interesting reading the article is that to me the article had no more relevance. I think that people are done caring, actually. I mean, we're risking people being done caring. How are Muslims going to feel now? Mm-hmm. I think that with all the terrorism that's going on, I think prior to that, there's been a lot of sensitivity. And people having a debate, should people mock, should they not, should satire happen, when is it crossing the line between violence and free speech? But now I think people are like, we're done. This is not okay.
It reminds me of the reaction after 9/11, when the slightest nuance in one's reaction of any sympathy towards a Muslim cause anywhere was for a considerable period of time seemed to be off the table. That instantly got equated with sympathy towards terrorists.
Well, I think, when I think about it, I think what keeps coming up for me, and it's a little bit different than what you just asked, is, there's so many, sides to this whole thing. When you actually think about Paris itself, what really struck me when all of the protests were happening, or people gathered, and just said, this is not going to happen in our country. And the world leaders, or most of the world leaders, all showed up.
Whoops. Sans one. Yeah.
What was happening on that very day, was a Saudi blogger, young 30-year-old guy, father of three, who was also taking a stand for free press, just like the Arab Spring was all about freedom and free speech and free press. And he's being flogged for the first of his 50 of 1,000 lashes. And not one mention of that was happening when all the 4 million people gathered in Paris and the world leaders gathered in Paris. Not one person was saying about Saudi, why are you doing this? What are you doing? Stop this. And let's face it, every brand of, in terms of the terrorist groups, is the Saudi brand of Wahhabism. Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden, Taliban, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram. All of these factions that are out there right now are all from the Saudi brand of Wahhabi.
Wahhabi, you're going to have to help us out with Wahhabi.
Okay, so Wahhabism is their brand of Islam, which is a very, very radical brand of Islam. And they have spent a lot of money paying their clerics. In fact, there was a New York Times article just the other day that also mentioned $100 billion that Saudis have paid to their clerics to be able to spread their brand of Islam. And their brand is that very, very conservative, stringent, non-negotiable. It's not even Islam. It's really tribalism. It's tribal beliefs interjected into Islam. But that is, when we look at radical Islam, that's where it's coming from. And that's the elephant in the room because no one's talking about Saudi.
I think that's where the intersection, Mike, is where we get into a really interesting point of view, especially from the U.S. point of view. And that is, we talked about the Charlie Hebdo, and that's getting people upset. Well, here in the U.S., sure, we get upset about those things, but we really count on the fact that whatever your perspective, you should be able to say it. You can protest in any way you want. That conflicts, and yet we always think about as well, who are our allies? And the Saudis have been our allies in certain ways, and in others, not so much. And it creates a real complication here, and can our leaders figure out what that is, or is it just too complex for even the people who are in the midst of it in Saudi Arabia?
Or we just assume that our allies share the same ideologies that we do. I think that's what it was. I think that's what it is that Saudi Arabia is, for all intents and purposes, our ally. completely different ideologies, though. Do you see what I mean?
What's the definition of an ally then? Because it's one of those things where when we're friends, obviously you don't have to agree on everything with your friend.
Right.
But you're sort of on that same foundational track.
I think you're in the minority if you dig that deep into it and you just say ally or not ally, right? And that's what it is. It's either ally or enemy is what it's come down to. And I think that that's where we see the Saudis. Wait a second, aren't they? They're kind of on our side, maybe not. No. I don't know. But ideologically, totally different.
They've allied themselves with us when it comes to something like Russia, for example. Mm-hmm. They're helping to tank the Russian economy. But on the other hand, do they believe in free speech? I think not.
Well, and human rights as well. That's one thing.
We're upset
about how the Chinese treat people. Obviously, during the Sochi Olympics, we were concerned about that with homosexuals and whatnot. But then when it comes to this, exactly. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to this sort of thing, I mean, that's why, again, I think Mike's point is interesting that allies, yes, but if we dig too deeply, that's where things really get complicated. And I don't know if people are willing to do that.
I think that's a very fair point. And one to think of the next time you fill up your gas tank.
Well, absolutely. I mean, how many of us have been really excited lately?
Me! So excited.
You know, you get your Fry's points or Safeway points on top of the oil prices or the gas prices, and we've been really, really happy while all these other kinds of things are occurring. And it's interesting, you just mentioned, you know, Saudi's helping to tank the Russian economy. I'm not an economist, so I don't even want to try and talk about that, but it's a little, you know, if we just look at our own kind of how our farm subsidies have done to other countries, and we look at if Saudi continues to drop their oil prices and do this to other countries, is it also going to have an impact on us? Because we don't just import, we are trying to export. I mean, how is all this going to end up working for us? I mean, there's a game being played here on a lot of different levels.
And the underlying thing with gas prices is that gas is produced very, very cheaply in Saudi Arabia. It's being sold below cost right now in Russia. The shale oil that we are wanting in the north is not producible at current prices. It was producible when we were paying $4 a gallon for gas. At two, it's not economic, so that sits in abeyance for a while. And the Saudis continue to collect. They clearly benefit. But I think that the more enduring point, and the one that I think we forget, is the one you've made here, which is look at all that money that's gone into Saudi Arabia and look what they've done with it. And is this the behavior?
And doing with it. It's not just done. It is continuing, and it is being invested more and more.
And it is. I want to stay on France for just a couple of minutes because I want to get back to that because we kind of sidetracked over to oil prices. How did that happen? Because gas prices are so awesome right now. That's why. But then we did have a state of the state address, and we have a new governor, and I want to get to that a little bit later as well. Stick with us. You're right here. You're in the Think Tank on KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we have a new administration in town, and my college-aged son has his first memory of a male Arizona governor. Steve Goldstein, we have in the background a State of the State address, but not a whole lot of clues as to how this new governor is going to propose to deal with a $500 million deficit this year and $1 billion next year. How do you read the tea leaves?
Mike, the first thing I'm hoping for is we're past the ice cream puns. Now that he's actually in office, no more Cold Stone puns. Hopefully that'll be the first
one. Can we go with the mayor of Legoland, though? Can we go with the Legoland puns? Because that's
for a while. That's probably
let's stick with that. I like it, yeah.
I think going forward, there's an interesting optimism in the face of a huge deficit, which we didn't see when Governor Brewer took over, this enormous deficit. What are we going to do? There are some people who are saying we've cut enough. What are we going to go forward with? The most interesting thing about the state of the state to me that Doug Ducey had to say was that he says he's going to be an education governor, which, of course, Governor Brewer said as well. I don't really know what that means. I've spoken to a couple of people in the education realm from right to left, and they're still not really sure. They think he supports traditional public schools. But because it's Arizona, he's also a supporter of charter schools. But where's the money going to come from? Where can cuts be made to actually prop up education? We're coming down again to the fight over classroom spending versus administrative spending, and no one seems to know what the truth is.
Well, with respect to classroom versus administrative, I think the 900-pound gorilla is very simple. We have, 128 different school districts? I may have the number wrong, but it's really huge. And if you're going to have 128 different districts, you are going to get more money spent on administration because you have 128 superintendents, 500 assistant superintendents. You have this massive repetitive bureaucracy. Anybody talking about cutting administrative costs, I don't see how you do it unless you deal with that.
Well, we've all seen efforts to consolidate, and there was momentum for that, I'm going to say 6 to 8 years ago, and it seemed like a pretty sensible idea, and then it just went away.
What squashed it?
I think a lot of people who are, I'm just guessing, those who are beholden in their positions really thought, well, how are we going to make this work? Is that going to cost jobs? Is it really going to improve things? And again, until you try something, you don't really know what's going to improve it. We want to look at statistics. We're not sure which statistics are right because, Mike, I hate to say this, as a pollster, longtime pollster, you know what we can do with statistics.
Yeah. But let me say this, though. Let me say this. When you say, as a governor, I am a pro-education governor, what that means is I will spend money on – I'm going to spend money on education. That's what I'm going to do. And it really stops there. I think our governor is kneecapped, and I'll say this very openly. He's kneecapped by a new superintendent of public instruction that has no clue what the heck – which way is up, excuse me. And I don't know how he's – I'm pro-education, but, oh, I have to deal with her.
But, Mike, I think the nuance of that is this, which is that, yes, Diane Douglas is going to be the symbol for education in Arizona, but she really doesn't have that much influence. Mm-hmm. There's a state board of education, the governor, the legislature. They're going to tell her how much money she's going to get. She's a little bit more of a figurehead, I think. And I think she's a figurehead that some people are a little bit scared of. But at this point, I'm not really sure what direction that goes. The one thing that Ducey and his business background, I think, is interesting. If we go back a couple of decades when Fife Symington was in office, businessman's going to come in, run government like a business. You really can't do it because you can't run it with the speed of a business. You can't sort of lay off people as you want to. But Ducey knows how important it is to have an educated workforce, which I think if he can convince the legislature and others, that's going to be a plus.
Well, I'm looking at this and I'm seeing two things in terms of the money. One is on the K-12 level, you have that lawsuit, which the schools have won every round of, that says you have massively underfunded education relative to the mandate of the voters. And the education system is willing to settle that. We'll forego the, what is it, a billion in arrears. Just fund us forward. Is he willing to pay that? That's question number two. One. Question number two is this. He has indicated that new taxes, not only are new taxes off the block, but also there is a round of business tax cuts that have not yet taken effect. And he said that's off the table, too. So you're looking at a budget that has a lot of mandates and things that you can't touch, and you look at what's left, and the biggest single item that's left, about 10% of the budget, is the state universities. So is this education governor going to radically cut into the state universities and not settle? And if you're not going to do that, where do you find the money?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't have the budget right in front of it. We'll, you know, Doug Ducey is releasing his budget, so...
Well, come to it from a Doug Ducey slash business standpoint, okay? You have this big chunk of money that is due our school system in this lawsuit, okay? And Ducey sees what we alluded to in the last segment with 128-ish school districts and a very administrative heavy budget. So as a businessman, he's looking at this saying, I got this big chunk of money coming, and it's going to my pension program? Wait a second. This could build my business, but... I don't know. So I don't know if he's even excited about getting to that because most of it's going to end up away from the students anyway.
And unfortunately, it looks like the first 2 years of his administration are going to be, let's try to fix the budget, whether it's a Band-Aid or not, and he won't really even get to implement anything. We don't really know what his vision is because he can't really do anything for a couple of years.
He's very, very constrained, and he's imposed an additional constraint on himself by saying, I'm going to allow those tax cuts that are already in process to take effect. That, I mean, the number of options that he has in front of him are very limited. He said, for example, we're gonna do a hiring freeze. Well, that saves you nothing on day one, and over time, it saves you a little.
Also, in his State of the State address, he, like most people running for governor, Republican or Democrat, he's going to find efficiencies. Mm-hmm. He's going to eliminate inefficiencies in the system, which when you have a state budget of nearly $10 billion, those efficiencies, I think that's terrific, but that's really just a word, which when you get down to it, that's really not going to make any dent.
The efficiencies mean somebody has to get fired, right? And if that's your teacher, you're not going to see that as an efficiency. I mean, I don't remember the last governor that was in favor of inefficiencies. You know, that's it sort of is this thing thrown up. We're all in favor of it, but it's hard to see the big dollars. And if they are big dollars, somebody's going to be screaming, not about efficiency. They're going to be saying you cut something that was essential. And you know, everybody that's in there serves a function that is serving somebody.
What they think is essential. That's everybody's job is essential. Everybody thinks their job is essential. That other guy over there, cut him. Cut him over there.
That's right.
It's my other job is essential.
Absolutely.
I am the vice president of birthdays, by goodness, and no one will get a birthday cake if it is not for me.
But post-recession, what we've seen, too, is you've not seen hiring come back. So what you've seen is there used to be three people for three jobs. Now it's one person for three jobs. So that's why I think when we think about efficiency, Mike, I think your point's well made, and it's a fun point. But I feel like now, because of the post-recession, we're seeing fewer and fewer people whose jobs aren't that important, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair point. And the whole thing about the broader economy is I think we are facing a structural change in the economy that has been 20 or 30 years in the making. This is the efficiency, right? When you get into the private sector, efficiency leads to underemployment. It means you can do more stuff with fewer people. And we think that's good in government, but in the private sector, when that happens, we get a lot of people who are out of work.
Absolutely. And the stock market's doing well. And we know, of course, that affects things. You know, people are looking at what are the reports going to be? Is the quarterly report going well? And if so, you know, a lot of private companies are saying we can shave a little bit more. You know, it comes down to that. And I know people don't like the idea of fighting over income inequality. I don't know if it's a thing. Some people think it is.
And that has been a 30-year trend. If you look at the charts on that, they start around 1980, and they reflect not the policies, therefore, of one president or one party. There are some bigger structural things going on that impel us towards. You see what has happened with college graduates. They've basically maintained at lower levels of education. They've taken a bad hit.
All right, let's stick with our new administration, our new leadership here in the state of Arizona. All eyes on the new man, the former mayor of Legoland, Doug Ducey himself. We're going to dig in next on The Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we have been talking about the new regime in Arizona politics, and I think everybody has agreed that the biggie it absolutely is the budget. $500 million in arrears this year, and that means in the next 6 months, $1 billion for next year. Likely the real pain doesn't come till July 1 because the $500 million deficit, there is a little bit in the rainy day fund. My guess is that the governor says, well, let's exhaust that, and then we can make up the deficit for 6 months by dinking around. But July 1, the piper comes to pay. But let's go on to other thing, the state of the state effect address. What I got out of this is things that weren't covered, and I want to ask you about this, Steve Goldstein. He did not mention immigration. He did not mention Medicaid, which is the boogaboo to the right? Higher education, because perhaps numbers, as I suggested, means a cut's got to be in the work unless he's got magic that I can't figure out. Environment, Common Core, transportation, or SB 1062. Take your pick. None of those mentioned. What do you think's coming?
You know, Medicaid is the most significant one of those, Mike, but it's not the one that generated the most headlines. And obviously, SB 1062 did. And that's one of those that's another argument, too. How much did it really hurt Arizona's reputation? Were we really on the cusp of losing the Super Bowl if we went ahead with this? I think Doug Ducey's going to take a breather. There are people who disagree with me on that. I think he will say to Kathy Herod of the Center for Arizona Policy, I respect you. I want to work with you, but this is maybe not the time to do that. We went through all these negative headlines in the last session. I also think really Ducey wants to establish himself as this business-oriented leader and not get bogged down, because even he sees that even if it didn't affect tourism as much as some opponents want to say it did, it probably affected it a little bit. At least people reading headlines back in the day with Evan Meekum, even if it didn't quite affect things, there was that perception, and we know how perception becomes reality.
One more nail in a coffin that already had a lot of nails in it. I think taken by itself probably didn't do much, but in the context of a broader narrative.
And it seems like SB 1070 and SB 1062 get lumped together, and I think they're quite different.
Yes,
I mean, one can disagree certainly about whether they're good methods or not, but SB 1070 was attempting to address something differently. Maybe the people who were the leaders in addressing it were not the ones who.
And I'll tell you the untold story about SB 1070 is public attitudes towards that were favorable nationwide, and Arizona was 3 to 5% more favorable than the rest of the country. In other words, we were well within a national norm. SB 1062, a different story entirely.
SB 1062 came across as really discriminatory.
And explain, just in case anybody got lost in the sea of numbers, what is SB 1062?
SB 1062, I guess I'll present it from both sides. Those who wrote it described it as a sort of a religious protection bill, a religious freedom bill. Those who had certain beliefs were protected. Those who were opposed to it said, no, it's actually a discriminatory bill, taking away rights from certain people, focused on homosexuals.
You could have the right not to serve gays if you
if you have religious objections to do so, I think, with
no case study here locally to pull from. So it was basically a solution looking for a problem.
That is what it seemed like to a lot of people. It seemed like, wait a second, why are we throwing this out there to knock down people? It followed up on the so-called bathroom bill. Are we going to have transgender people using bathroom and kids may be in there? So it sort of blew itself out of proportion to as a social issue. Whereas 1070, of course, we know was meant to keep people from illegally crossing the border and we would prosecute them and whatnot. There were many, many levels to it. And the Supreme Court shot a lot of it down. That actually, at this point, especially depending on what the Senate and the House do, maybe that is revised in some way, or revived, rather.
So you think that the business community will end up with the governor's ear, more so?
Yes.
And by that, I mean the sort of the big business people.
Yes.
The people who back Medicaid, interestingly.
Absolutely.
Which he says he's against.
Well, I think he is, again, showing his pragmatic side, which is, as a businessman, he's saying, I may not have thought this was great. I'm not a big fan of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, but I think this is going to keep us from having a budget buster. So I think that's why he will, even if he doesn't support it, he will sort of straddle the fence, I think, as much as he can.
Only a slightly nuanced difference from that position taken by Jane Brewer.
Absolutely. Although he will not be out front. I mean, Governor Brewer became very defiant in her last couple of years, saying, if I think this is the way to go and you disagree with me, I'm going to be out front. The tax increase, which, of course, no one expected her to support a tax increase. Once she decided to support it, get out of her way.
But then she boxed herself in because she said it was temporary and it solved the state's problems for 3 years. Then it went away, and she had already gone on record saying that was temporary. I'm not going to.
But she did it right. She did it the right way. She gave it to us. She gave it to us to vote on, and that's the way to do things. That's the way I've supported her in that from day one. I was against the tax increase, and guess what? It passed. There it is. The will of the people.
I think again, that's where cross-section between the governor and the legislature go, because the governor looked good on that, Mike, but the legislature looked like, here they go, can't decide again, kicking it down the road.
I'd like to ask Jalene, in the sort of the perspective of conflict resolution, what comments do you have on the way these things sit, these kinds of SB 1062 and things like that?
Well, I'm sitting here smiling to myself and actually wondering how to quite phrase it, but it's really interesting that we have, you know, very visceral reactions to any kind of thought that anybody could be have any aspect of Islam projected onto our culture or society. And we hear about, you know, being anti-Sharia law and all these different things. And then I look at some of these bills and I'm thinking, huh, it seems like we're trying to even propose our own version of a Christian form of a Sharia law at different points in time to project, you know, what we consider then the right religious beliefs.
Oh, but that's our team.
Right, absolutely. And so it just makes me smile because it's, smile or cry. I'm not quite sure which way to go, because then it's like, where do we go from here? I mean, it's so interesting how this is all unfolding and how it continues to take place, and that nobody sees the parallels and no one sees the connections between the two.
No, you can't. We have the blinders on there. There's no way we would ever draw a parallel between our beautiful Christian utopia that we have here in the United States and Sharia law. You know, but the lines that you draw, it kind of brings that into focus, really. It does.
Well, and it's interesting because, I mean, this doesn't have to do with the Arizona conversation, but again, there was another, I don't know if you saw in the news yesterday on the headlines, but there was, you know, the picture of all the world leaders, just taking it back to Paris for a second, an ultra-Jewish conservative newspaper removed
all the women
Merkel.
From So
we talk, again, when we're talking about all this religious persecution or religious rights or whatever, however we want to phrase it, it's just fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of different elements here, and there's no religion, there's no those projection of those values that goes unscathed. And that's actually what our country is supposed to be about. We're supposed to have this separation of church and state. We're supposed to be anti all of this potential projection of Islam or anything else onto our culture, because we are a separate of church and state and all these things. And yet we are also working very hard to bridge and become a church-based state.
But there are a lot of fundamentalist Christians in this country who reject the notion of separation of church and state.
Absolutely.
So, and they say that, no, this is a Christian country. And that is inherently a statement that no, church and state are not separate. So,
and certainly goes back to politics. I mean, that's changed over the past few decades since Jerry Falwell probably gets the credit or the blame to some for starting that out. And now you have focus on the family. You get, because people who are serious about this, much like senior citizens, will vote. They will get together. They think these issues are important, and they're really influencing politics as well as the rest of the world.
Well, I heard that and I read a beautiful article out of CNN. This was last year I read this, was the last taboo. The last taboo in United States government and in politics is atheism. That is the last one. It's no longer being a homosexual. It's no longer being non-committed to your husband or your wife. It is atheism, and that's it. That is the last standing taboo.
About 30% of the population is states that they are either agnostic or atheist. One member of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You don't say you're an atheist and run for Congress because it's the kiss of death.
Yeah, you got to pick a side. You got to pick a team. You got to run.
I suspect the real numbers are somewhat higher, but that's the I think the stated number all by itself tells you something, that politicians have a sense of what's an acceptable way to put yourself forward, and atheist, a non-believer, that doesn't cut it.
It all seems part of that increase of information. In the old days when the reporters wouldn't talk about politicians cheating on their spouses, they also didn't talk about religion quite as much. Now we have to know which church our presidential candidates go to. Of course, Mitt Romney ran. What do we know about Mormonism? It's very confusing to us. So
it started with Kennedy. It started with a Catholic. What in the world would we have a Catholic as president? That is just lunacy.
You know, the interesting thing about that is, among Catholics in particular, there used to be a Catholic vote, and it voted relatively monolithically. Now it's very divided, and the key religious divider is not what religion you are, but how often you go to church.
Heavy
duty churchgoers vote different from less heavy duty churchgoers, regardless of denomination.
Let's wrap a big fat bow around this, as we usually do right here at the end, the final segment. Thanks for spending some of your Sunday with us right here on the Think Tank, KTR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
All right, Doc, stop booking guests that sound better than us on the radio. What is up with that?
Hey, I was just thinking, isn't it easy when you got guests who can carry the show?
I had my feet up most of the time. I was thinking, this guy's in for a job. Well, we want to thank them. That was very insightful. I loved it. I'm excited. I did see the State of the State address, Doc, and I'll tell you that I was a fan of Brewer. I really was. I loved her maternal view of this state. I enjoyed that. There were some things that we disagreed on,
my favorite analysis of the Brewer governorship, and I've mentioned this before, is a friend of mine who's an engineer, and said she was a governor in the engineering sense. When things started to go a little far in one direction, she'd pull them back.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Kind of keep us from going too far off in any direction.
And we can hope that Doug Ducey is from that cloth. We only know of a campaign of Doug Ducey is what we know. We don't know everything about Doug Ducey.
Which means the devil's in the details. We don't know that much yet. Really.
Right.
Because even the State of the State address, and I think appropriately so, you don't get into mechanical details when you do that. It's inspirational,
sure.
and that's appropriate. But here's the real... We know only one thing. We know we're facing a big deficit, and we know he said any tax increase, including the ones that aren't, haven't even taken effect. You know, we're not even going to forestall the ones that are looming, tax cuts. Okay, how do you make the numbers add up? A budget is coming out very shortly. That will tell us a whole lot more than we know. So something's got to give. And particularly, as I said earlier, I don't think it's so much about the next 6 months. You can raid the rainy day fund, deplete that, and you can kind of get us through July 1. Then there's going to be some pain that's going to go around.
I want to think, and once again, we're just learning about Doug Ducey, and I'm excited. That's why I'm excited, because this might be something great for the state. We don't know yet. But I think I want to think that he's smarter than, I'm not going to worry about tax increase. I'm going to say no tax increase because I'm going to deplete all of our reserves until January 1 when, oops, now we're out of that and I get caught with my hand in the cookie jar and now I have no plan. It'd be tough on day one to do a State of the State address and say, I've got this, no tax increases, without a plan to do so.
Yeah, well, he's certainly got to make it work now. I mean, this is what happens when you become governor instead of a candidate. A candidate can get away with a lot of smoke and mirrors and really not answering things. But the pedal goes to the metal now. What I thought, by the way, something that Steve Goldstein said, I just reminded me of something that takes me back a few years, but... the conflict in his supporters. He's got the sort of the business conservatives. He has the social conservatives. In 1980, Ronald Reagan had those two factions as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did in 1980 was to sell the social conservatives, wait a minute, we have to readjust our economics.
Yes.
And you guys are going to have to wait for a while. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing, when Steve Goldstein made his comment that what he thinks is going to happen would conform exactly to what Ronald Reagan did in 1980. And the economic conservatives were happy. And over time, the social conservatives started to get fed up with Ronald Reagan. And at some point down the road, not so much in the Reagan years, but in the Bush one years, said, no, we're not going to wait. We're not taking the back seat anymore. We want ours now. And that's when they started to impose more rigid criteria for their support. They basically felt like they got taken for a ride in the initial election or two, and they say, no, now we have our agenda. It will be very, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. It's what Steve suggests. But if you tell one of your two factions they got to take the back seat for a while, they may do it for a while, but at some point, there's going to be some internal pressures. It'll be fascinating to watch.
We have a businessman at the helm. This is interesting to me, and I like to look at this because I'm a small business guy. You're a small business guy, and you understand, and I think I have a pretty solid grasp on what it takes when you look at the numbers. You can't run as the head of a company. You can't run from the numbers. You cannot. They're right there. They're staring you in the face. Your projections, your trajectories, you have to look at all of those, and then you have to make the tough decisions. I hope he's the guy that wants to make some tough decisions.
Those are the real ones. I mean, because you can say I'm pro-education, but now we're looking at budget.
Yeah.
Where are you going to put your money?
Right.
How are you going to do it? And he said two things. He said, the tax cuts that are scheduled, we're going to let them take effect. So that's going to increase the deficit. Number two, a hiring freeze. That's relatively minor stuff because, you know, it doesn't save you a nickel on day one. And by the way, every hiring freeze that's ever been done is very porous.
It's horrible.
Well, it has to be because you say, wait a minute, if your teacher quits, are you going to not replace her? Are you going to double up? You're not going to.
Sure.
There's all kinds of stuff that when you get into the particulars, you can't do. There's other stuff.
The process has already started in some cases. The budget's cleared for that, and it's already there and ready to go.
Some of it you have to fund immediately. Some of it you can hurt yourself, but only over the long haul, so you get away with it for the short haul.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what we all like to see is there some of it that really is fat that you don't have to do, but reasonable people would disagree about where that is.
He's on a tough side with this education. Oh. He's on a tough side. Being a Republican, he's on a tough side. And here's why he's on a tough side, because he knows that the knife has to come out, that some cuts have to be made or some restructuring or some sort of Chapter 11-esque reorganization has to happen. And in that, he's going to have to let some people go. When that happens, the Dems, and it's from their playbook, and you know this, I'm not ripping on them. It's a good play. It's a great play. You're anti-kids. You are hurting our kids. It's all about the children. You're anti-education because you got rid of three administrators.
And the one source of real budgetary efficiency that you could get, cutting the number of school districts,
yes,
is a multi-year process. You don't do that between now and July 1.
But to start that process.
That would be votes of the people and whatever.
Still to start that process, it might be toxic politically. It might be in a red, red, red state. It might be toxic politically.
It would be interesting to see, does he go there? Because that is the obvious source of efficiency. Otherwise, you can do this mandate. You can say, you must put more money into the classroom, but that's hard to do when you've got so many districts.
Right. I remember walking into my kid's school just this very week. I walked into my kid's school. They forgot their lunch money. I forgot someone was delivering something to the administration after the school had started. And I walked in, brand new, everything. They have, in elementary school, a gymnasium that a high school would be honored to have in an elementary school. And I remember thinking about the discussions you and I have had in the past about the Taj Mahal-like schools that we have. It almost seems to be everyone outbuilding everyone. And my thought was, why did I just show up with 5 bags of supplies for my kid's classroom when all of this just happened?
Yep.
Day one,
that is one of the differences we have with some of the schools that outperform us in other parts of the world. They don't.
Yeah.
They don't build the structures. They pour the money into the classroom, which everybody
wants in theory.
Would all love to see 90%+ of the money go into the classroom. But
yeah,
then you look at all the things that keep that from happening.
Right.
And those things tend to be politically protected.
Day one, all administrators, you work out of a portable on one of the campuses, period. What? I can't do that. What are we poor? No. Yes,
well,
we are
rent poor. The portables. You've already paid for the Taj Mahal.
Oh, geez. Here we go. go with this noise. Here we go. It's sell him his office space at that at that point. Do you have any sort of rosy picture of the future of Arizona? Or are you cringing at the state of the state?
Well, here's the long-term thing, is that the economy is coming back. This doesn't solve this year's problem, but we are in a very readable, demonstrable recovery. Now, we've not recovered as fast as the rest of the country. We used to have unemployment about 1% below the national level. Mm-hmm. We have been tracking 1% above.
Sure.
And that's because basically we have had an economy that is really tied to real estate, and real estate hasn't come booming mm-hmm. back.
Sure. And I hope it doesn't come booming back.
Long term, we need a more diversified economy if we're going to really see. So, I mean, and there was a article in the 1980s came out. It was a big, big thing. Barron's article, which old timers here would remember. It says, Phoenix is a one industry town, and that industry is growth. That was an overstatement, but there was a kernel of truth in that.
Right. But as far as real estate's concerned, it's trending how it probably should be. It can get a little better, but booming back, seriously. Right. I know you might be underwater right now in your house, but a boom back just puts us into jeopardy again. Let it take time.
We have the lowest number of foreclosures than we've had since before the Great Recession.
Right.
So that this is turning, and yes, you don't want a boom because a boom gets you a bust. You want slow, steady growth, which is very unsexy.
And I'm tired of hearing that, by the way. I've been hearing it over the past 6 months. But we are at this level now, and before our recession or during the Great Recession, we were at this level. Everything was going to right itself eventually, and it's righting itself. The Republicans, Democrats, both taking victory laps and patting themselves on the back. No, there's a lot of free market at play here as well.
You know, when you get booms, you get busts. We had one in the 80s, particularly in real estate. And mm-hmm. if you look at it, real estate prices, for example, historically end up being some predictable multiple of incomes. You know,
and I'm looking at the Dow right now at about 17,000 near 18,000. Hmm.
Good if you own stock.
Yep. Well, it's a boom.
Yeah,
but it's a boom.
But it's a boom that largely was created by efficiencies and cutting back jobs. You know,
exactly
the efficiency that
right.
we want. You know,
I'm with you there, and $1 trillion thrown into the system, and well, with stimulus and things like that. So I'm not too excited
but it's a favorable trend. The question is building on that, and the problems that we face, the fixes are long term. That we want instant fixes, and they're not there. You know, we get a more educated public, we bring in better kinds of business. That doesn't happen in 6 months.
It doesn't. All right, Doc, thanks for being great to have you back, man.
Good to be back.
Great to have you back. All right, thanks for spending some time with us. We'll be here next week, folks, right here on the Think Tank.